Welcome to the Blue Security Podcast, a weekly podcast for information security defenders, where we bring you discussions on best practices, tools, and implementation for enterprise security. Now, here are your hosts for today's show, Andy Jha and Adam Brewer.
Welcome to another episode of the Blue Security Podcast. I'm Andy, your host.
I'm Adam, your co-host.
We have a good show lined up for you today. The first thing that I wanted to chat about is MSRC, the Microsoft Security Research Center, published a blog about a month ago. And I just wanted to talk about it real quick because I think overall it's a really good effort. It's something that I think will move the needle and also maybe convince other companies to be a little bit more transparent. So this blog, which of course we'll link in the show notes, is pledging greater transparency when identifying and determining root causes for security vulnerabilities in Microsoft products and services. So the blog goes on to say, for decades, Microsoft has used their own proprietary taxonomy to describe vulnerability root causes. And going forward, root cause data for Microsoft CVEs will be published using Common Weakness Enumeration, or CWEs, the industry standard. And overall, this is core to the goals of Microsoft's Secure Future Initiative, where they were outlining some engineering priorities to transforming software development, implementing new identity protections, and improving transparency and faster vulnerability responses, which was published by Charlie Bell, who's one of our executive vice president overall for Microsoft Security. So I thought this was really good. Microsoft is being more transparent and using an industry standard when you're looking at these root causes for these vulnerabilities. And yeah, I just overall thought it was great.
As a reminder, Andy and I both work for Microsoft in our security sales business in the field. So we're not directly involved in decision-making around this, but are of course impacted by it as we speak about it to customers. And the Secure Future Initiative has been in the news a lot more recently, with Satya Nadella sending an email to employees now 10 days ago, really reiterating the importance of this. And so this is something Microsoft announced last fall, but I think there's been more conversation around it recently. And we're seeing impacts of this internally, where things are changing faster than I can ever remember in terms of user impacting changes. A lot of things have been improved as a result of this initiative. And it really is a company-wide initiative. As I mentioned, CEO Satya Nadella emailed all employees about it. And he really drilled it down to very simple terms. He said, if you're ever given the choice of doing security, maintaining legacy compatibility, building new features, your choice is clear. Do security. And I appreciated the simplicity and clarity of his message there. And I think a lot of other Microsoft employees did too. So this is in service of that, aligning to industry standards, which we've done a lot more of recently at Microsoft. A lot of our other security solutions map everything to the MITRE ATT&CK framework. And we compete and are part of MITRE, like the Ingenuity evaluation and other ones of its ilk. So I think you'll continue to see more of this moving forward. And I think you'll see a lot of change as a result of this initiative. And it's really exciting times, I think, in a lot of ways in how we can find and improve security across the company. And you mentioned Charlie Bell. Just for folks who aren't familiar with him, he was hired on, I want to say, into one. And his initial goal was to unify our security engineering, making security products. And I think his purview has quietly grown to really encompass everything security related, not just product based, but how we secure Microsoft as a whole. And he reports directly to Satya Nadella on the senior leadership team. And when you look at how Microsoft is structured, if you sit on the senior leadership team, it's because the product you represent is very, very important to Microsoft overall. And so you look at folks like Scott Guthrie, who's responsible for Azure and Azure engineering. You look at Phil Spencer, who is responsible for Xbox. And now we have Charlie Bell for security as well. So security is right up there. If you think of major brands of Microsoft, Surface, Xbox, Windows, Microsoft, Azure, security is a seat at the table right alongside them, which really does emphasize how important it is moving forward.
So the next thing that I wanted to chat about is I found a report published by Honeywell on USB malware hack. And unfortunately, the report is gated behind some marketing email. You have to like submit your information. So I wasn't able to read the whole thing because I didn't really want to do that. But I was able to find a lot of information from people who had and So just wanted to chat about it. So the industrial giant Honeywell, they published their sixth annual report on threats posed by USB-borne malware to industrial organizations and warning them of an increase in sophistication. I actually was unaware that Honeywell had published five of these in the past, but it's definitely something to keep an eye on, especially in if you're in that industrial manufacturing segment. A lot of it focused on OT and IoT attacks with USB, and the report specifically focused on malware found on USB storage devices where they would carry them into and out of industrial facilities. So many attackers, as part of this report, are using USB devices to establish a silent residency in industrial control systems. The report found that instead of simply exploiting vulnerability, a lot of intruders hide and observe operations before launching an attack that will leverage inherent capabilities of the system. And the malware targeting the system is specifically used in the industrial facilities. 31% of the malware attacks are targeting industrial systems and sites, and the percentage of targeted attacks has been on the rise since 2015, when the report found only 16 of malware attacks were industrial targeted. So it's gone up from 16% to 31% in the last five some years. Similar to past years, more than half of the malware was designed to target and spread via USB, which does help malware cross air-gapped systems. In addition, roughly half the malware was capable of connecting to a remote CNC server. About 20% of the USB-borne malware was content-based, abusing existing document or scripting functions rather than exploiting new vulnerabilities. And Honeywell said in the report that over 13% of the malware blocked specifically leveraged the inherent capabilities of common documents such as Word documents, spreadsheets, scripts. An additional 2% of the malware specifically targeted known vulnerabilities in common document formats. An additional 5% specifically targeted the applications used to modify and create these file types. And then another concerning trend is the frequency of the malware. Honeywell said that the amount of malware that was blocked relative to the total number of scanned files has increased by approximately 33% compared to previous years, which in turn recorded a 700% year-over-year increase. So that's pretty concerning that this is another vector that attackers are increasingly trying to get, and they're ramping up the number of attacks as well as the sophistication. So overall, the report found that removable media such as USBs are increasingly used in targeted attack campaigns. 51% of malware attacks are designed for USB, which is about a sixfold increase from 9% in the 2019 report.
Oh, wow. That is concerning. And I will share my experience, and Andy, you have a similar. Andy and I, for a while, worked together in our manufacturing-focused enterprise operating unit at Microsoft. And so all of our customers were manufacturers of some kind. And as I would go in and talk to security decision makers at these organizations, almost universally, they had no purview, no knowledge, no visibility into OT networks. It was essentially as if they were told, hey, grownups are talking here. You need to go buzz off and do your own thing. Go worry about your little IT stuff, and grownups will handle the OT stuff. Which, in my experience, if it's left to operations alone, they're probably not doing all of their homework on securing their environments. And we know this to be true because there's so many embedded devices, brownfield devices out there on manufacturing floors across the world. Honestly, very poor security posture. And as you mentioned, Andy, and this is almost a throwaway line, but I'll go back to it. Usage of USB is critical because it allows this malware to traverse air-gapped networks. So even if you say, well, it's fine, our OT network is air-gapped, it doesn't have any internet visibility anyway, we're fine. Well, you're not, because you could fall victim to these attacks, which are increasing significantly year over year, essentially since the turn of the decade. So this is deeply concerning, and I think everyone needs to take steps to mitigate it. Obviously, a great first start would be for our security teams, our InfoSec teams, to start to get a seat at the table with these conversations and start to work with their peers side by side in operations to start to harden and protect these networks in particular.
Yeah. And when it comes to air gap systems, like you said, Adam, a lot of times for these OT, IoT networks, security doesn't have a seat at the table. So, and I also think that network security as a skill set has really kind of decreased in priority over the years because we have so much open networks these days, flat networks these days. And so even if it's air-gapped, security may not know what the rules are in place and what is actually happening if there is no visibility within these networks. And a lot of OT devices now require you to talk out. So a lot of times they are cut off, but maybe port 443 is open if initiated from the inside. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that is concerning is if a USB was able to connect and air gap that system, it says in this report that a lot of them are capable of talking to a remote CNC server, probably over port 443. So if it's initiated from the inside, it connects to that CNC server, and now you have command and control because it was initiated from the inside. So they block it, obviously, like initiating from the outside, but malware was, you know, carried in through the USB. There's a lot to think about here. There's always exceptions when it comes to these networks. Like when I've talked to customers, they say it's air-gapped, and I'm like, when you dig a little bit deeper, they're like, well, actually, this is open because we need it to be, or something like that, right?
Right. And that's my experience too, Andy, and I'm glad you called it out because I was going to if you didn't. For those listening and not watching the video podcast, I'm going to say air gap in scare quotes, as in my experience and everyone I've spoken with, it's a myth. Nothing is really air gap today. It's maybe really locked down with really tight firewall rules, but ultimately there is still a connection point. There is a cross communication going on somewhere.
So most importantly, I think what I want to talk about reading this report is what can you do in order to kind of look at your policies and strengthen your defenses against something like this? Obviously, you can block all USBs from being able to connect. There's a lot of ways you can do that. A lot of XDR, EDR solutions automatically can do that. On a IoT or OT system, that can be a lot more difficult because you can't really install like an agent or something like that on those systems. But overall, like on, say, I know a lot of industrial or IoT devices may have a PC connected to it with some sort of software that runs it. I've run into that plenty of times where the vendor of the system that you're using for manufacturing or industrial purposes has a PC that is connected to it that may have other exceptions, like you can't reboot it for OS updates or anything like that because, number one, you can't have any downtime, and number two, maybe the software that's running on it is meant for a specific version of the OS, and if you update it, it breaks whatever. So they lock that system down. But obviously, if it's a PC, you can connect a USB to it. And so those may have EDR or XDR agents, if possible, installed on them, and then you can, say, block things. You can also block it just via GPO. Even local GPO, you can block a USB. That's been around for a long time. Obviously, Intune as well, you can do that. So a lot of different ways you can block all of it. You can have an allow list. I know plenty of customers, plenty of organizations that block block all USB devices, and then they have an explicit list where they allow the serial number of issued USB devices, and you can have an allow list where it's a company issued one. The military has been doing this for years, where you have to get an issued USB or external hard drive if you need it for business purposes. Many, many organizations do that. And that's a good practice, where you can implicitly block everything if it's something new, and then have an allow list. And you can do this scanning as well if something connects to it, regardless if it's allow or disallow. You can have your XDR, EDR just automatically scan that drive or either malicious processes that automatically run, or if a file on that device matches a hash or a known piece of malware, it can just block it or clean it up. Something like Defender AV Always On Protect, you know, that's able to do it if you turn it on. Other EDR and XDR solutions have very similar things. Another thing that's built into kind of the Defender stack is what was known as Defender Exploit Guard previously, but now it's Attack Surface Reduction Rules. These are built into the Windows system, and you can block untrusted and unsigned processes that run from USB. So a lot of homegrown malware is not signed, although that is changing. But if it is untrusted and unsigned, it can automatically just get blocked via attack surface rules. And that's just built into the system. You can have that as a rule just deployed in your organization. And then the other thing I wanted to talk about real quick as part of kind of more endpoint focused is kernel DMA protection. This is something that's built in. Kernel direct memory access protection is a Windows security feature that protects against external peripherals from gaining unauthorized access to memory. So when PCIe hot plug devices like Thunderbolt, USB 4, CF Express, when those devices are plugged in, it's a class of external peripherals like external graphic cards, and it has like a plug and play ease of the USB. These devices are DMA capable, so they can access system memory and perform read and write operations without the need of a system processor involvement. The capability is the reason and why these PCI devices are so performant in like Windows systems, but they also make them susceptible to drive-by DMA attacks. So one of the things that you need to check, because automatically, if there's a system that supports DMA protection, it enables it automatically. So there's no user or IT admin configuration required unless you somehow turn this off by policy. So it's something that I would check in your Windows security settings to see if memory protection, otherwise known as kernel DMA protection, is enabled. And then finally, you could create custom alerts. Like if your EDR or XDR or SIM allows it, you can have some sort of scheduled query or advanced hunting query to look at unknown devices that are plugged in. I know for Microsoft's Defender for Endpoint, you can go into advanced hunting, scope out, and just see what USB devices were plugged in. And you can have an alert if something malicious or just anything gets plugged in.
I think this is a great start, and don't sleep on this. Because even though Andy talked about how a lot of those IoT or OT devices don't really offer the ability to run an agent on them, keep in mind that the threat has to come from somewhere. And generally speaking, that's going to be someone provisioning some sort of USB device. Maybe it's with a firmware update or some sort of settings change, and then sneaker netting it over to the OT thing that they're going to plug it into, potentially. That's one of the risk vectors here. And so ensuring that your PCs are still healthy, you're only using trusted systems. We're doing on-demand scans when devices are plugged in. We're doing attack surface reduction rules to prevent stuff from running from USB devices. This is all helpful. And you can use your existing EDR, XDR solution. Attack surface reduction rules, I believe, are available for anyone with Windows Enterprise. You don't necessarily need to deploy Defender for Endpoint or anything else to take advantage of those. They're native to the OS, not the Endpoint Protection Suite in particular. And so there's a lot of good advice here, because again, this is really where these threats originate in most cases. If you get a USB device mailed to you from some sort of device manufacturer and you go plug it in directly, you know, that's really, you're relying on them anyways for security. There's not a whole lot you can do there. So I think these are valuable call outs. You're probably doing a lot of these today, but it goes back to something I talked about earlier, which is really InfoSec needs a seat at the table with securing IoT and OT networks. They need to understand what the processes are. How often are we sneaker netting a USB device over onto the manufacturing floor and sticking it in something? How often does that happen? What is the process to do that? How can we build some resiliency and some protections into that process? Having those conversations is probably the most effective tool in our toolbox, is bringing these teams together. And then we can get into the individual tactical steps we can take to help protect it as well.
Now, when it comes to IoT and OT devices, like you said, Adam, we worked in the manufacturing industry. By and large, when we talked to customers and asked them what their strategy was for this, it was kind of hands up in the air. We don't really have a strategy. We don't really know. We don't know how many devices there are. We don't know what type of devices we have. We don't really understand the environment. And I think just starting out, you need to have an understanding. Security begins with visibility, knowing what you have, an inventory of what you have, and mm-hmm. visibility over that. And then you can start to decide how you want to secure that. So have something, this needs to be a part of your strategy if you have OT and IoT devices. So as far as Microsoft goes, IoT has moved over to the Defender for Endpoint solution. So if you are a Defender for Endpoint, like an E5 customer, we now have the IoT part of that kind of built in, mm-hmm. where we use endpoints that have Defender for Endpoint installed on them, and they will constantly kind of scan the surrounding networks and pick up signatures of IoT devices on those networks. And for OT devices, we have a solution that we have purchased a long time ago. It used to be called CyberArk.
CyberX.
Thank you. Not CyberArk. CyberX. And they were a leader in the OT industry. And a lot of them now work for Microsoft in that specific solution. And it's been rebranded as Defender for IoT or OT or whatever you want to call it. And that's specifically more OT based, which requires sensors that are deployed on your network. And of course, again, it's not like most of these devices can't really install agents. So it is looking at signatures, looking at behavior on the network. It can at least see a fingerprint of the OS and firmware updates and stuff like that. So they're definitely more network-based security, but it can detect, obviously, if you have a beacon that is talking to a CNC and it might be a known CNC IP address or something like that. So having at least some sort of strategy looking at that is extremely important if you have those type of devices as part of your organization.
And keep in mind, it doesn't require you to touch or change anything. So I know you'd get pushback on this, but the only thing you have to do is connect Defender for OT to a SPAN port on the network. And as long as it can see all of the chattiness happening, all the different controllers talking to each other, it can give you really rich readout on inventory, on potential risks and that sort of thing. And it's something you can do even if you're totally brownfield. You've got existing devices already deployed. You don't plan to rip them out and change them anytime soon. This can still be helpful. And keep in mind that OT is in its infancy in InfoSec compared to where IT is. And so a lot of these devices, they kind of tell their life story over the network. They talk about everything. Hey, here's my version number. Here's my controller number. Here's my firmware number. And just reports that out freely in the packets they send because they're used to being on these, you know, allegedly secure networks. I use scare quotes again for those listening. And divulge a ton of information essentially over the network. So don't think of it with your IT hat where it's like devices should not reveal anything in their packets and they should be really buttoned up and everything should be encrypted. Like OT networks aren't like that. Everything is clear text and everything is pretty open with sharing its current state. And so you can learn a lot just by sitting on that network and listening to what everyone's talking about. And that's something I would say if you have that kind of environment, you should have in place. Just like Andy said, there's really very little downside to it other than the cost to deploy and maintain. But otherwise, it's just another set of eyes that doesn't impact your day-to-day production. And even the most hardened operations folks should be willing to go along with that because it gives them visibility with really no downside or downtime, which is what they're concerned about.
And then just to kind of mention at the end here, because any type of USB attack, we're obviously talking about malware executing from it, but another thing that organizations worry about is data exfiltration over USB. So we're not going to dive too deep into this, but data security should be part of your game plan when it comes to USB security. I mean, most, if you're not using full disk encryption, BitLocker, FileVault for Mac OS, full disk encryption for Linux systems, if you're not doing that, you're probably...
you have homework.
You have some stuff to do. You definitely need to do that. And then DLP and endpoint DLP. So when it comes to like exfiltrating data from a Microsoft standpoint, we call this endpoint DLPs. Having rules in place to scan for different DLP rules when it crosses a barrier from the OS into USB itself that can trigger a DLP rule or some sort of protection rule. So on top of, you know, maybe the block and allow list that you have for USBs, right? If you have an allow list, okay, now we're going to look at the content that you're transferring from. So maybe even though the USB is allowed, there's data that's transferred back and forth. So have some sort of data secure solution or project going. This is huge in today's, you know, AI driven environment. Data security, I think, for me and Adam has been a huge conversation topic. A lot of companies are they don't have it. You know, it's the same as IoT and OT is. It's always been pushed down the list of priorities and they haven't really gone into it and looked at it. So definitely start that today if you haven't before.
Yeah, great final call outs. And data loss prevention, hugely important. Andy, I think you really laid it out very cleanly for our listeners and viewers. It's one thing to say at a course authorization level, I allow this. Then the second step is, well, what content do I allow on it? And from a Microsoft perspective to us, data loss prevention is something that happens when data is in motion. When data is trying to cross a data boundary, that's when we're going to do that inspection and say, should this be allowed to cross that boundary? And that's what data loss prevention is for. But keep in mind, information protection, sensitivity labeling has a seat at the table too. Because if I have the KFC secret blend of herbs and spices, the secret recipe, and I have that already protected with a sensitivity label, you can go throw it on a USB all you want. You can go leave it in Times Square. It's protected with really strong encryption to the point where, with current technology at least, I can't decrypt it anyways, even if it did go on a USB, even if it did fall into the wrong hands. So we're always trying to build defense in depth, defense through layered approach to security. And that's where data security comes in. If you do all the things with between the full disk encryption, between the course authorization of what devices we allow, to more the fine-grained authorization of data loss prevention, to sensitivity labeling, now you've really given yourself a holistic strategy around protecting that data because there's multiple points of protection throughout the stack.
So great conversation today. We'll put all the links to a lot of the documentation that we talked about in our show notes. Thanks for watching and listening. As always, my contact information as well as Adam's will be in the show notes. Please reach out if you have any questions, concerns, or topics you want us to talk about in the future. Thanks. We'll talk to you guys next week.
Thank you for listening to the Blue Security Podcast. Please check out the show notes, catch up on episodes you may have missed, and subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. Find Andy on Twitter @AJawZero and Adam @AJBrewer. See you at our next episode.